8 years ago, only weeks after Facebook launched the Ivies, Howard gave a keynote at South by Southwest about his 2002 book, Smart Mobs, The Next Social Revolution. Years before Twitter and Foursquare, NFC and Square, my dad wrote about a future which people will leave messages in places and mobile phones will become a remote control for the physical world. A decade before the Arab Spring and the Occupy movement, he predicted that the merger of mobile phones, personal computers, and the internet were lowering barriers to collective action and were going to enable new ways for economic, social, and political revolutions. Sound familiar? In 1985, 2 years before the first South by Southwest, he wrote Tools for Thought, The History and Future of Mind-Expanding Technology, in which he envisioned the future of personal computing when hundreds of millions of people around the world would be a part of a networked community, and how this will change the way people think, learn, and communicate. He warned that nobody knows whether this will turn out to be the best or the worst thing that the human race has done for itself, because the outcome of this empowerment will depend in large part on how we react to it and what we choose to do with it. My dad now returns to this notion of how we react to and use these tools at a moment when critics like Nicholas Carr and Sherry Turkle are asking, is Google making us stupid? And if Facebook is destroying our ability to connect with other humans? In his new book, Net Smart, How to Thrive Online, Howard warns that the future of digital culture depends on how well we learn to use the media that have infiltrated, amplified, distracted, enriched, and complicated our lives. And he introduces five essential literacies for the 21st century. Please join me in welcoming Howard Rheingold. Hi, have fun.
Thank you, Mamie. Best intro ever. If you fear that the use of social media is turning people shallow, then why not teach more people how to swim so we can all explore the deep end of the pool? The way you use a search engine, stream video from your phone, update your Facebook status matters to you, to me, and to everyone, because the way we use these media now will influence the way they're used and misused for decades to come. Recently, a lot of powerful criticism of social media impacts and the costs of our use of social media have emerged. Technology criticism is important to pay attention to, and it is particularly important to think critically about what we are paying for the benefits of our use of social media and what we may be losing out on when we're online. Critique is important. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient. Knowing that something is broken is important, but it doesn't always tell you everything you need to know about how to fix it. Instead of confining my questions to, is Google making us stupid? Is Facebook commoditizing our privacy? Is Twitter chopping our attention into micro slices? All good questions. I've been asking myself and others how to use social media intelligently, humanely, and above all, mindfully. I've looked to my own nearly 30 years experience online. I've looked at the research, the scientific and scholarly research, and I've talked to as many of the social media masters as I could, people whose names you would recognize, Dana Boyd, Jane McGonigal, Jimmy Wales. NetSmart is about what I've learned. What I've learned is that literacies are important now. And by literacies, I mean not just the skill of encoding and decoding, like reading and writing, but the ability to use those skills socially in concert with others, You know, if you do fall into the deep end of the pool, knowing how to swim is going to serve you well. If you're the only person on earth who knows how to read and write or make a web page, that's not going to serve you very well. So I've concentrated on five literacies, starting with attention, the fundamental literacy, participation, which is what brings us all here, cooperation, of which there are many flavors available online, critical consumption, or less politely, crap detection, and a set of knowledge, different kinds of knowledge, I call network awareness. And ideally, all of these literacies ought to work together. So let's start with attention. Attention is really the fundamental building block of thinking and communicating. I first became aware of it in the classroom when so many of the students were looking at their laptops instead of me. But of course, we all encounter attention issues every day. How many people have you bumped into at South by Southwest because they're walking down the street looking at their phone? I have a statistic. I don't know how legitimate it is that 1 out of 6 people have bumped into somebody, not just at South by Southwest, while looking at their phone. In the classroom, I realized that my students didn't know what it looked like to stand up and not see them, but to see their laptops. So, with their permission, I took a little video of them, and then I projected it on the screen. I put it on YouTube, again with their permission, and I projected it to the class. And notice that this student, while I'm projecting it, has decided he'd rather watch it on his laptop. And then, for some reason, he switched over to my website, while I'm showing the video. And then note, he checks his email. Now, the interesting thing about this student is that he was one of the rare A-plus students. Years go by without an A-plus. And I'm pretty sure that if I had stopped him and asked him what I was talking about, he would have been able to tell me. Probably you have heard about the research that indicates that 95% of the people who think they are more efficient while they're multitasking are actually less efficient. Most of that research cites Cliff Nass, whose office is right down the hallway from mine at Stanford. What about that other 5%? Is this student one of that 5% who somehow can multitask? To me, the interesting question is, was he just born like that, the way some people are born to run faster or jump higher? Or did he learn something on his own that if we knew how he learned it, we could manage and train attention for others? I came to think about the most important step to training attention as mindfulness, or if that sounds a little spiritual to you, metacognition. The idea is simply to become aware of how you are deploying your attention, to begin to know and to make decisions rather than simply be attracted to the latest buzzing of your smartphone or the latest link that comes across your attention online. In class, I asked the students to develop a number of attention probes. For example, a student would ring a chime at a random interval, and then we would all write down on yellow, orange, or red post-its whether what we were thinking about was directly related to what was going on in the classroom, whether it was tangentially related to the topic under discussion, or whether it had nothing to do with it at all. Then we would all put our post-its up on the whiteboard. You could tell pretty quickly just by looking at the colors what was going on. The interesting thing about mindfulness or metacognition of attention is the more you do it, the more you are capable of doing it. Although meditative disciplines can take many, many years to master, getting started is extraordinarily easy. It simply has to do with looking at what you're doing. When you're looking at what you're doing and you're paying attention to your attention, when you're online, when you're paying attention to information, I call that infotension. And infotension has two parts. One of them is inside your mind. The other part is on the screen, the tools that you use. Every day, every minute, we make decisions, whether we do it consciously or not, about what we're going to pay attention to online. Am I going to click on that link? Am I going to watch that cute kitten video? We make these decisions without thinking about them much. The idea of infotension training is to begin to make them more deliberately, and then ultimately make them deliberately and faster. Am I going to pay attention at all? Or am I going to open a tab and look at it later? Or am I going to tag it and bookmark it for some time in the future? These decisions, if we can make them in the context of our goals, of what it is we're setting out to do, can help us become more mindful or metacognitive. We all have tool sets online. Many of us use dashboards like RSS readers. I've found that matching the visual arrangement of my information, my dashboard online, to my attentional strategy helps me to train my infotension. It helps to have a visible goal, and of course, nobody but you can determine what your priority for any day is. So at the beginning of the day, I write on a small piece of paper the two or three things I need to accomplish by the end of the day, and I put that piece of paper in the periphery of my vision on the desk. So every once in a while, my vision falls upon it, I think about it, and I simply think for a second, what am I paying attention to online, and is that going to get me to my goal? Nothing coercive, just becoming aware of it. I've taken a leaf from B.J. Fogg at Stanford, who studied how to cultivate habits, and he says, start small, find a place for it, and repeat. So there's nothing complicated, there's nothing very large about just writing two or three goals on a piece of paper and putting it in the periphery of your vision. If you do it every morning before you get started, you've already begun to establish a habit. And as I will explain, beginning to establish that habit with your mind actually begins to change your brain. So in the book, I get into a great deal of detail about attention and how to train attention. I just briefly want to recap a couple of the highlights. One is that attention can be trained. I think the issue with attention, 99% of the issue with attention, is that people really haven't thought about controlling it. Breathe. I got this from Linda Stone, who noticed that many people hold their breath while they're doing their email. She calls this email apnea, and traces this back to the fight-or-flight response. So our ancestors walking around the savanna with a lot of potential predators, if they heard a sound, they would stop and hold their breath, and their body would begin to prepare them for fight or flight and flood them with a lot of hormones that would be useful in combat or in flight. But of course, we're not being followed by saber-toothed tigers 500 times a day. So we're amping up our nervous system in ways that we're not equipped simply by holding our breath. So every once in a while you're online, take a deep breath. Attention to intention is how the mind changes the brain. Whenever you have a particular thought or you pay attention to something in particular, that causes a specific network of neurons to fire. And neurons that fire together wire together. The more you think about something, the more you are aware of something, the more that strengthens that neural network, the more likely you are to be aware of it in the future. Meditative disciplines, of course, know about this with mandalas and mantras. Simply paying attention to where your attention is online becomes a habit that becomes ingrained in your nervous system. So let's talk about critical consumption. When I started looking at this issue, I came across Ernest Hemingway's quote, in which he said, every good journalist should have an internal crap detector. So more often, I call it crap detection. I first came across this when my daughter was in middle school. This was before Google existed, and search engines were AltaVista and InfoSeek. And I had to explain to her, because teachers were new to this and they didn't know, that you could go to the library, and this had been true for a couple of thousand years, and you can get a book out, and you might disagree with that book, but you could be pretty sure that there was an author, an editor, a publisher, and probably a couple of fact checkers who tried to check whether the claims of truth in that were accurate. And as I told my daughter then, you put a term into a search engine, you can get an answer to any question instantaneously. But it's now up to you, not the publisher of the information, to determine whether it's accurate, inaccurate, good information, bad information, disinformation, or misinformation. One thing I did back then, and I do now with students, was I asked them to search for Martin Luther King. And you'll notice that the third hit from the top is Martin Luther King Jr., a true historical examination. That's true on Google. It's also on the first page of Bing as well. So if you click on that link, you get a website that looks like it's an authentic website about the civil rights leader. If you click down on it, you'll find that they don't have a very good opinion. In fact, they have a pretty bad opinion of Martin Luther King Jr. So my daughter asked, well, how can I tell whether this is the real thing or not? And I said, well, look for an author. It turned out that there was not an author on this site. Now, this was a number of years ago, and since then, they have outed themselves, I guess because they've been outed so many times, and they note who they are. But if you use who is, you put the URL in for any website, you can find out at least who is claiming to be responsible for that website. And here, it turned out that someone called Don Black at something called stormfront.org was responsible for martinlutherking.org. So search on the name of stormfront.org, and you'll find out that it's a white nationalist community that had grabbed that domain name. This one was a lot scarier the first time I came across it, because it was just one page, and it didn't really offer a lot of evidence other than what you might rationally deduce, that it was a joke. Notice that the ads are real ads for pregnancy tests, but this claims to be a free online pregnancy test. It says, enter your name and click on Start Pregnancy Test. So I entered the name Joe and clicked on it, and a little flash animation came up that said, sit still while we scan you. And congratulations, Joe, you're with child. It offers me the opportunity, or Joe the opportunity, to view my baby, so of course I wanted to see, and it turns out that it's a girl. Well, I think most people can tell that this is a joke by this point, although I think that there are a certain number of pregnancies every year that are caused by people who are not quite clear on where babies come from, and I worry about people who might take this seriously. Of course, the deeper you get into this, the more clear it is that it's a hoax or a joke. So, of course, I wanted to find out who's the daddy. And it turns out to be Fabio. I've tried it another time, and it turned out to be Newt Gingrich. You could go on. You could pick another daddy. You could go to the birth certificate. But, you know, this is just one example of many I've collected about websites that aren't entirely what they seem online. So this one looks pretty legitimate. It's a nice, slickly designed website. First Genetics, they claim to have genetically engineered a primate, a mandrill, that can understand English and can communicate by typing on a keyboard. Totally bogus. A lot of teachers use this, the endangered Pacific Northwest tree octopus, a completely non-existent species. Notice the link at the bottom. I have a link of dozens of examples of websites that are either hoaxes or, like the Martin Luther King Jr. site, a cloaked website, or inaccurate, or jokes. So again, I get into a lot more detail about crap detection in the book. It becomes extremely important when you're searching for medical information. I don't think that there's anybody these days who doesn't Google their symptoms, or certainly doesn't Google the name of the disease when they get a diagnosis. The wrong information could be fatal in that case. And of course, in the political sphere, the same thing holds. Think like a detective. Look for clues. If there's not an author, that's a clue. The kind of design of the website can be a clue. If it's poorly designed, that's a clue that maybe it's not what it says it is. But if it's well designed, as you've seen, that does not necessarily guarantee its veracity. Search to learn. You know, most of the time, you just want to find out where's the nearest pizza parlor. But if you're trying to learn something, don't stop with the first search result. Don't stop with the first page or the second page. Go on and do further searches. Looking at the snippets from what you find often gives you a good idea of what to search on next. Look for an author. If a website doesn't have an author, I would turn my credibility meter way down. And if it does have an author, look that author's name up in the search engine. Journalists triangulate before they pass along reports. So I was on Twitter one night, and there was a report that the Egyptian government had shut down the internet in Egypt, and that seemed like something worth repeating. But I didn't see anything on CNN. I didn't see anything on Al Jazeera. So I wanted to triangulate by getting three different sources for that report. I did see a report from someone I knew to be actually in touch with people in Egypt who said he had talked with someone on the telephone, and they had confirmed that they could not get internet access from there. Someone else reminded me to use ping, to try to ping a site in Egypt, and it looked like the sites in Egypt were down. So those were two points in the triangle. When I saw another news report, then I passed it along. Recently, Eli Pariser has written The Filter Bubble, and a few years ago, Cass Sunstein wrote about The Daily Me, about the fear that people are paying more and more attention to only those sources they agree with. We all have networks that we pay attention to, and I urge you to find people whose intelligence and veracity you respect, but whose opinions you disagree with. If nobody in your network annoys you on a regular basis, then maybe you are in an echo chamber. So participation. I don't know how well you can see this slide here, but it looks like it's probably an Austin crowd in this slide here. And we are here, and South by Southwest is here, because the web is not a medium in which a few people create culture that's consumed by the rest of us. The web is a medium in which we all create culture in small ways and large. I just want to give you a few examples of the power of participation. When Warner Brothers, the copyright holders for Harry Potter, tried to shut down a fan site in which people were writing fictional reports about Harry Potter, Heather Lawver organized a worldwide boycott of Warner that backed them off before they found out that she was 16 years old. A relatively unknown blogger by the name of Bev Harris was obsessed with Diebold, the company that makes the voting machines we use, and who have been very secretive about how those machines work. She found the source code for the voting machine used in the USA online, and she copied that and passed it around. A group of students at Swarthmore put that on the Swarthmore server. Diebold sued them, and the federal court found that American citizens do have the right to know how our voting machines work. She was a pretty unknown blogger, but it was picked up pretty quickly and passed up the food chain until millions of people were paying attention to it. You all probably recognize Wael Ghonim, one of the young revolutionaries in Egypt who used social media, among other things. And there's been some degree of controversy about the role of social media in the Arab Spring. I interviewed Alaa Mousaf, one of the activists who worked on this, because I had been in touch with him for years through my Smart Mobs website about the role of social media. And according to him, it had been used for years for people to organize who couldn't organize face-to-face, many of the exiles. And of course, Mark Zuckerberg was 19, and the Google twins were in their early 20s when they invented what are today multi-billion-dollar industries. I emphasize the youth of these participants to show you that the knowledge of how to create a blog or use a wiki or create a website can be extraordinarily powerful, powerful economically, socially and culturally, and politically. So in the book, I talk about many different ways that people can participate. And these days, a certain amount of attention is being paid to curation, which I think is an appropriate way to start. There's a lot of information online. There's a lot of bad information online. And we are doing a pretty good job of beginning to filter the good stuff to the top. It's not just about eliminating the bad info. It's about finding the good info. And I like Ross Mayfield's Power Law of Participation. He posted in 2006 that plots the low threshold with the tool on the left and the high threshold with an online tool on the right to low engagement with community and to high engagement with community on the vertical axis. So it's very easy to read a website, to subscribe to a website, to favorite or like or plus something, to tag something. You can get a little bit more engaged by commenting or subscribing or sharing. You can go all the way to creating a virtual community. Involvement with low threshold, lightweight participation usually leads people to higher engagement, higher threshold participation. So curation is not only a way to leverage collective intelligence, to find the good information, but to build collective intelligence with others by making judgments about which of the sites that come across your attention are worthy of other people's attention. The benefits of curation start with the fact that we all need to transform information overload into useful knowledge. We need to make decisions all the time about which information about a particular topic that we are studying is worth keeping for ourselves and at the same time passing on. I'm going to talk about the architecture of participation here. The genius of social bookmarking that started with Delicious is that there's no additional cost to you to make the decisions that you have to make personally, publicly available to others. And in the aggregate, that adds up to a very valuable public good. In the open source community, they call it scratch an itch. You scratch an itch when there's something that you have to do for yourself that you make available to others. So let's say a new printer comes along. There's not a driver for that printer. You've got to write that driver. You might as well put that into the public code pool. Not only are you doing a public service, but you are enlisting others so that when that printer might be changed, others are going to help you change that driver. You have to tag and bookmark for yourself anyway. Make those choices available to others. If you want to gain a reputation as an expert in a domain, one of the best ways to do that is to spend part of your time saving time for others by picking out the best information you can find in that domain. And it's not just social bookmarking. We've got a number of curation tools available these days. We've got Storify and Pearl Trees and Scoop-It. There's a new one every day. People who know what they're doing are going to know that you know what you're doing when you give them good information that saves them time every day. You also send signals that attract others who share your interest in a particular topic. It's a little bit like personal SEO. When you are on a daily basis, sending out a list of things worthy of paying attention to about your topic, whatever that topic may be, others who are searching for good information about that topic or passing around sources of good information about that topic are going to find you. And they're going to begin sending you information that you're going to find valuable. Social scientists use the term social capital to refer to the ability of individuals and groups to get things done together outside of formal institutions like laws and contracts. We all use and build social capital every day, And online, curation is a great way to build the networks of trust and the norms of reciprocity that are the building blocks of social capital. When a lot of people participate, we get an effect on the entire society. Henry Jenkins calls this participatory culture and notes that a citizen who regards themselves solely as the passive consumer of culture that's created by others thinks of themselves differently, thinks of their ability to act differently from someone who thinks of themselves as a contributor to culture in whatever small way. There are many, many ways to participate. There's a new one every day. No, self-election is one of the things that makes open source work. Instead of having a manager telling you what to do, you figure out what it is you want to do and do it. And when that adds up, you get open source or you get Wikipedia. Figure out which form of participation works for you and works to your advantage, and you help build participatory culture at the same time that you are doing yourself a good. So again, I get into a lot more detail in the book, but some of the highlights is don't just consume information online, create it. Create, if it's not original information, create decisions about what's good information from others. Architecture of participation was a term that Tim O'Reilly used when he described the way the technical architecture of the web enables individual acts of self-interest to add up to powerfully useful public goods. It's not just altruism. It happens to be that the web enables us to act for ourselves and at the same time act for others. Curation is a lightweight form of collective intelligence, a form of taking advantage of collective intelligence by finding good sources of information about the subjects that interest you, and a good way to create collective intelligence by contributing decisions. I asked Henry Jenkins, who studies a lot of different fan cultures online, what's the first piece of advice you would give someone if they get into some kind of online community before they begin participating? And he said, figure out what the rules are. So learn what the norms and boundaries of local online cultures are before participating. Doesn't mean that you have to study it for days, but think before you act. Read the FAQ, for example. And crap detect thyself before broadcasting questionable info. If you want curation to work as a positive force, then you have to make decisions about the validity of the information that you're passing along to others. Collaboration comes in many flavors, and I'm just going to touch upon some of them here. Each one of them is a subject in itself, and we have vast capabilities now to collaborate and to engage in collective action with others that were not possible a few years ago. Anybody in this room here 8 years ago when I keynoted about smart mobs? Okay, a couple of you will remember that I talked about the merger of the mobile phone, the internet, and the personal computer, lowering the barriers to collective action and predicting that we were going to see a lot of outbreaks of political activity of the kind that we hadn't seen before. Well, of course, now, 10 years later, from Arab Spring to Occupy Wall Street, I don't need to belabor the point. This is a form of collaboration that not everybody is going to participate in, but everybody in the world needs to understand why these things happen and how they happen. Virtual communities, probably a few of you were pretty young. My daughter was 3 years old when I wrote the first article on virtual communities in 1987. Whether you are a gamer or a cancer patient, you probably participate in a virtual community that means a lot to you on a daily basis. There are good arguments to be had over what community means. By the way, there is not a definition of community. Sociologist George Hillary came up with 94 different definitions found in the literature. I'm always careful about making a judgment about the validity of somebody else's experience. There are people for whom their virtual communities are a lifeline, and there are people for whom their life online is an escape from their face-to-face participation. I think it's impossible to generalize without knowing the circumstances of an individual. But without a doubt, when I first started writing about it, you needed an expensive server and expensive software and a lot of technical knowledge to set up a virtual community. Nowadays, any of us can set up a Google group in a couple of seconds. Message boards, hashtag Twitter chats. There are all kinds of ways that people can communicate with others either instantaneously or asynchronously on a regular basis about the things that mutually interest them. Distributed computing started quite a few years ago when the search for extraterrestrial intelligence sucked down signals from outer space and converted those into digital material and started looking through that digital content for possible signals from other civilizations. It turns out that American taxpayers don't want to pay for this, so they enabled people to download a screensaver that woke up when their computers went to sleep, downloaded some of this information, ran a pattern recognition algorithm on it, and reported back to SETI headquarters. The point here is not that little purple people are trying to send us messages. As far as I know, none have been discovered. The point is that at one point, this was the most powerful supercomputer in the world. 2 million volunteers, 30 teraflops, 30 trillion operations per second. And of course, it's not just searching for life in outer space. If you go to folding.stanford.edu or you use the online game Foldit, you can help biochemists understand how protein molecules fold, which is really essential to understanding the immune system or creating a new medication. Weather modeling, all kinds of computation that wasn't really possible even with the most powerful mainframes are possible now. So I ask the question, in a few years when we're going to have billions of people walking around with supercomputers in their pockets, linked at greater than what we consider to be broadband speeds, what kind of computation is going to be possible that's not possible today? Crowdsourcing is not just something that businesses use. Breaking up a task into a lot of small elements and enabling a large number of people to accomplish those elements can be used in a number of ways. A couple of years ago, computer scientist Jim Gray went out on San Francisco Bay in his sailboat, and he did not come back that night. So his friends organized. They got the latest satellite photos from Google and NASA. His friends at Microsoft divided those into 500,000 pieces, and they put it up on Amazon's Mechanical Turk, where thousands of volunteers searched through those 500,000 images in just a couple of days. They never found Jim Gray, but this was just something that was put together ad hoc, overnight, using the tools that are available online. When I spoke here 8 years ago, Wikipedia was just really getting started. I don't think many people would have bet back then that it would have millions of articles in hundreds of languages by now. I don't think that Wikipedia is the end of new forms of collective knowledge gathering and collective intelligence that we're going to see online. Cooperative learning is exploding these days. I know there's a lot of attention to the massive online courses like the AI course at Stanford, and that really scales the kind of teaching that's done about how to learn a partial differential equation or how to write an AI program to many more people. But the kind of learning that requires discussion and question and answer among different people, that's really exploding too. We don't just have colleges and libraries anymore. We've got YouTube, we've got Wikipedia, and we've got millions of sources of information and powerful means of communicating with each other. People are beginning to put together things like peer-to-peer university to teach each other using what we've got online. I think this is another powerful form of collaboration that is just beginning to get started. You know, we've been told a story about how humans get things done for many years, and it's based on the idea that biology and human society and business is fiercely competitive. It turns out that more recent knowledge in a lot of different scientific disciplines has revealed that complex interdependencies and cooperative arrangements are just as important as competition, that organisms and individuals cooperate as much as they compete. Small actions, really lightweight ways of participating, can climb that curve of engagement into really full-scale forms of collaboration and collective intelligence. There's a wide variety of ways to participate, and if you want collaboration to happen, it really helps to enable people to pick the way that they participate, enable self-election. People contribute online not just for altruism. A survey that was done about contributors to open source found that the number one reason was to learn how to code. So people contribute to enhance their reputation, which can be turned into money, to learn, to meet others, and to add to a public good. And in fact, I think it turns out that a mixture of motives works better than just idealism or just financial incentives. Casual conversation builds trust. Back to social capital. People do things together with others when they have a little bit of trust. It's why when you meet someone you don't know, you talk about the weather, you talk about sports, you're just beginning to find ways that you might have things in common. So a lot of the trivial chit-chat that you see on Twitter, for example, is actually a way for people to get to know what kind of human being you are beyond the kind of cold information that you put out or the information you seek. Casual conversation builds trust, and social capital grows from networks of trust. The fifth of the five essential literacies I call network awareness. And I've really assembled little pieces of knowledge from a number of different fields. The assembly of this knowledge is new to a lot of people. It's not really rocket science. It's not even algebra. It's not even learning the multiplication tables. It's that this knowledge has been somewhat siloed in different specialties. A lot of people are aware of the kind of knowledge that's coming from network science. So the idea of small worlds, that the shape of a network influences the behavior of individuals, the power law, and the long tail have become popular among people online these days. It comes from network science. It affects the way we participate online every day. Social scientists have looked at issues like the presentation of self and identity and individualism for a long time. It turns out that what they have learned can teach us a lot about the online version. Reputation is something that's age-old that is suddenly important in very many different ways online than it was in just the physical world. For those people who know the components of social capital, bridging capital, bonding capital, and reciprocity, they're going to be able to work to their own advantage and to the advantage of others simply by knowing that. Social networks are a lot older than the internet. They're as old as human sociology. And sociologists have studied the forms of social networks for a long time. Now we have these online networks that multiply for good and for bad the effects and the characteristics of social networks. Ideas like strong ties and weak ties that you had to be a sociology student to understand now become increasingly important. And there's this idea of Dunbar's number, that humans can only maintain about 150 strong ties. What's important online is the maintenance of weak ties that you can mobilize at any moment. And a kind of tie that really wasn't talked about by sociologists, someone that you used to know but have lost touch with, Facebook, for better or worse. They're the people you can't get rid of, and then there are the people that you can stay in touch with even though you've moved on. Terms such as social media, viral media, the network society, and network publics have become very important for those who want to understand what's happening in the world today. Now, if you put all of these isolated pieces of information together, you get a kind of awareness of the way networks work. It's going to enable you to function more effectively, and it's going to make the commons a richer place. So, again, these are just a few of the details that I get into in a lot more detail in the book. Networks have structures, like the small world network, that influence the way individuals and groups behave. A portfolio of both strong and weak ties is useful both to individuals and to a networked society. Position in networks matters. It turns out that centrality, how many people have to go through you to get to others, can be more important than just the raw number of contacts that you have. Diverse networks are collectively smarter. Research has shown that if you get a collection of experts about a particular topic, they're going to make decisions that are probably less good than a collection of people with very widely differing knowledge about that subject. And interestingly, the research has indicated that collective intelligence works better when there are more women in the group. People who can bridge different networks, who can connect people, each of whom have connections to powerful networks, fill what are called structural holes. Those people stand to benefit. Pay it forward. Again, empirical research has shown that the strongest indicator of whether you're going to get help from someone online is whether you've given help to someone online. If you go way back to when I was talking about curation, you are sending out a signal that you are a cooperator and maybe someone that deserves others' cooperation. New media and new literacies are not slowing down. The development of new media and new ways of using them has gone into hyperdrive. If you want to keep up, don't just keep up with the hardware and the software. Don't just keep up with the technology. Keep up with the literacies. I'm going to be signing the book immediately after this in the bookstore. You can download the first chapter in the table of contents from my website. And I thank you for a significant portion of your attention. I'll be happy to answer questions. If you have questions, put a mic right up here. So come on up to the mic.
Dysfunctional communities in Colombia, and there was a researcher named John Sadarsky. He performed a very structured analysis of different levels of social capital creation, performed a quantitative analysis of it. One of the elements that they identified in their study was that one of the particularly high indicators of social capital within an individual was something that they called the faith in unsubstantiated information sources. Which they basically equated that to people who are had less social capital, had a lower index of social capital, tended to believe what was transmitted through mainstream media like television and so on. And those who had higher indices of social capital were those who were more engaged with their community and also trusted mainstream media less because they were getting other sources of information, conflicting information, validating it. The point that you were making about the echo chamber and the point that you were making about how important it becomes for us to become crap detectors and also to curate lead me to a question. To the extent that if we take the idea that sort of the faith in unsubstantiated validation sources is an important component of social capital, if we start from that premise, and if we then go to the idea that the internet is now one gigantic unsubstantiated information source, to what extent can we, as people who are involved in the interactive space, start working or collaborating on building perhaps tools to help doing that, or to perhaps even create initiatives to start spreading the kind of net literacy that you're talking about. The first point, of course, is the book you're writing, but then the follow-on piece is, how can we take on that information and start creating that kind of culture?
The connection between crap detection and social capital is really interesting one. I'd be interested in that reference if you want to send it.
Absolutely, I'll be happy to do that.
Howard@Rheingold.com.
Yes.
I wrote this book as to provide something that knowledgeable people like you would learn something new from, but also that you would give to the less knowledgeable. So if you know a smart parent who is concerned and not very knowledgeable, that's what the book is for. Or a good gift for a high school graduate. I wrote a syllabus for college professors to use. Any college professor who wants to teach a course from the book and from a lot of other sources that I've indicated can use that. And so I've made it a Google Doc. I will make it widely available in the near future. And I've created another version of it for high school. And I'm asking, I don't know anything about high school teachers, teaching high school. I've asked high school teachers to help me create that. So I think it's really important that we begin spreading ways of teaching this in formal institutions, but also at home. Institutions take a long time to change. I think concerned parents, many of whom are made nervous by a lot of the moral panics online, are a good source. Tell your friends.
Thanks. Thank you.
Hi. A lot of my work is I'm doing research on the information needs of low-income communities in a democracy. And one of my questions is, you were talking about how self-election is a big, important part of what makes open source work. And I'm concerned that low-income people and people who are just traditionally underserved by all kinds of media don't really self-elect to participate in online participatory culture.
Yeah.
How do we do that? Do we need human intermediaries? Do we need to... Is it a matter that they don't feel that they have something to contribute, or is it a matter that they feel distrust? I mean, what would you point me to sort of learn more about that?
Well, a lot of the research by Esther Hargitay seems to indicate that there's a strong connection between the education level of parents and the ability of students to crap detect. Mm-hmm. So the digital divide is not just about access to technology, it's about access to know-how. I think one of the places that we are seeing people from lower socioeconomic groups and marginalized groups beginning to participate is in what are called interest-based communities. Gaming is a great example of that. Gamers are peer learners. They are teaching each other the norms and the tricks of the game. There's something now called connected learning. If you go to connectedlearning.tv, you'll see resources. The idea is to connect this interest-based learning that has a more widespread demographic distribution with the peer learning that interest groups participate in, with the kind of learning that's supposed to take place in schools.
Great, thank you.
So you mentioned you showed a picture of your class and everybody had their phones out and their screens up.
Yeah.
Yesterday, I walked by a restaurant that had like a large picture window, and all these people were sitting alone in this restaurant. Everybody was looking at their phones, and the person I was with, we were laughing that there had to be 15 people sitting close together and having no human interaction.
Yeah.
How do you take what you're talking about and at the same time get people to take a break and look to the person next to them and say hello? Because when we walk into breakout sessions, people spread out by four people, take out their phone, and nobody wants to interrupt them. How do we mirror the human-to-human connection with what you're talking about?
Well, I get into some detail about this in the book. I take Sherry Turkle's critique very seriously, in large part because she bases it on a lot of empirical evidence. And she's afraid that we are using our media to distance ourselves from each other. I think that we need to spread habits of closing your laptop, putting your BlackBerry away. When your kids are talking to you, look at them and put your BlackBerry away. These are norms. They're not laws, they're not rules, and they spread, and norms spread through groups like this very rapidly.
Thank you.
So I think we have time for one more question before time's up here.
Well, I actually have sort of a couple of questions. The first one is, what do you feel, where is the line between mindfulness and hypervigilance? And the second one is, obviously, you know, like with fact-checking and verification, you know, for just general crab detection, how do you feel it's sort of possible to retain anonymity and privacy online with so much transparency? I mean, with the transparency and verifying, you know, and stuff, you know, like Facebook.
Okay, let's see, my short-term memory. Let's take these one at a time, okay? I suspect, although I don't have any kind of scientific evidence, that this taking a breath has a lot to do with distinguishing mindfulness from hypervigilance. When you're hypervigilant, you are probably holding your breath. So I'd say, again, just notice what you're doing when you're hypervigilant. And, you know, the way you hold your body when you are sitting. And of course, if we were to see the entire World Wide Web, it would look a little bit like this. You need to begin to get up and move your body at regular intervals. And I think hypervigilance happens a lot when you get frozen into a posture. Your second question?
The second, as with sort of losing one's privacy online and having to verify your identity, how do you feel it's possible to, you know, create content but retain anonymity and privacy online?
Awareness is the most important part. No, I was one of many people who warned about what was coming 10 or 15 years ago. People didn't really care, and for the most part, they don't really care today. People are very willing to trade their privacy for convenience and the illusion of security. When people are shown how much information can be aggregated about them, they are quite often shocked. At least that's true with my students. So I think understanding that what you put online is going to be online forever, that it can be searched, that it can be duplicated and spread around instantaneously, are the facts of life that you need to tell your teenager before they get online. They may not care about their drunken Facebook pictures today, but they will care about them later. Even if they're aware of that, there are a lot of things about their profile that they need to be aware of when they start. When you start participating online, you begin to build a digital profile. Your footprints are going to be indelible. And again, what are you going to do about it? I don't think we can make laws about it that are really going to stick with the whole world. And I think education is the most cost-effective, fastest way to do that. So I think tell your kids, tell your students, about what some of the consequences are. I get into a lot of detail in the book, and Dana Boyd was one of my best sources of information about what to tell teenagers. So again, I want to move before we get into the next session. Thank you for sticking around. I'm going to be signing my book in the bookstore right out here. This is the only place you can get this book right now. It was shipped directly from the bindery, and it will show up in bookstores over the next few days and weeks.